This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we experiment with cold water immersion as a technique to help us deal with cold weather. But here is a name that you will be familiar with, Doug Hamilton. Of course, the host of Main Street has been out on medical leave since June, and he joins us now to touch base with the health journey. Doug, welcome. Thanks for being on Main Street.
Well, it's great to be back on the air, however I do it.
Well, we miss you and we look forward to the time you can be back on the air more regularly. But for the listeners who aren't aware of anything besides Doug has been out on medical leave, you have been out with acute myeloid leukemia. What kind of cancer is that?
It's a mean one. Among the leukemias, it's probably one of the meanest. And I was diagnosed on the 25th of May. I've had cancer before, prostate cancer, which was back in 2006, and I had a minor recurrence of it in 2008. And what I remembered from that, my sense memory, was a certain kind of fatigue that is unique to that experience, at least for me. And about a week before I called the doctor, I was starting to feel this. On May 24th, I called the doctor, and they saw me right away. And they noticed some tiny red dot spots on my legs, which are called petechiae. And they are indications of burst capillaries.
Oh.
And what that is an indication of is a very low platelet count. And platelets help you, your blood clot. So they did an extensive test of my blood that day. And for some reason, I had my phone turned down, but they were ultimately trying to text me to say I needed to come in right away to the emergency ward because I had an extraordinary low platelet level, and if I'd had any kind of injury, I might have bled out. So I spent several hours in the emergency room at Sanford's main hospital and subsequently was transferred downtown to the Roger Maris Cancer Center, and that started my initial trek, which was about 38 days of hospitalization there, where I underwent chemotherapy. I was told of my diagnosis. And mind you, I knew I had something. I just didn't know it was that. And I can't say enough about the quality of care that I've received all along my journey. Dr. Czar was my doctor at Sanford, and now he's, as you probably read in the forum, he and his wife, his new wife, are both going through their own journeys with cancer. So I was given chemotherapy there to deal with the advancement of the leukemia. And indeed, it worked very well. The leukemia was in remission, but of course, no one was expecting that to last very long.
Yeah.
In the meantime, almost immediately, I was given the news that I would be a candidate for a bone marrow transplant, because that's really only the only really effective treatment for this. So they were essentially prepping me for that.
Wow.
And that's what led me to Minnesota Fairview, which is where they do bone marrow transplants. And they've been doing them, interestingly enough, since 1968.
Wow. Probably changed a little in those years.
Oh, hugely. I mean, every patient probably brings some refinement to it, and they've dealt with, I think, tens of thousands of patients now.
Wow.
So I felt extremely fortunate to be there. And when I arrived at Minnesota Fairview, I was marveling at my own personal history, because 50 years ago this fall, I was starting as a grad student at the University of Minnesota. And my experience at the university was between Stadium Village and Dinkytown, which is, for those people who know the campus, is where the main central campus of the U of M is. South of Stadium Village to the Mississippi River is where this now incredible hospital and clinic complex has developed. It's literally building shoehorned into the area. And one of those buildings has the bone marrow transplant clinic. And so that's where I had my initial consult. And this is the part that amazed me and should amaze listeners too. I met with a Dr. Mukta Arora. She was my transplant doctor on a day in September. And she told me that in the near future, I would likely be contacted by their transplant coordinator. The next day, I was contacted by the transplant coordinator.
Wow.
Who said they had found many, many full matches. And that they were confident enough at that point to schedule me.
Wow.
So that was just awe-inspiring. I couldn't believe my good fortune.
Well,
because,
yeah.
Because, you know,
people,
time is of the essence.
People can so often wait for a long time for a transplant. Sometimes people even die while on the list for certain kinds of transplants. Did they give you any indication of, since there were multiple matches so quickly, is that because you have a kind of a bone marrow that lots of people have and there are lots of donors, or how was it that it was that simple, relatively speaking?
Well, interestingly enough, and I think this is sobering in a way, I had the good fortune to be a Northern European by descent. And on the International Bone Marrow Registry, is a national and international one, there are hundreds of thousands of potential donors. By far, the vast majority of them are Northern European, for whatever reason. I was told by the transplant people at Minnesota Fairview that my donor, and it's not identified yet, was a 26-year-old man. And while they weren't sure where he might be living, it was quite likely he might be German or Polish, because they get so many donor people from those two particular countries. But the sobering thing here is that if you're Southern European, if you're African, if you're Indian subcontinent, the potential matches drop off dramatically, simply because the word hasn't gotten around to those populations about the potential for donors and, you know, life-saving bone marrow.
Wow.
Literally, it's the luck of the draw, and I was very, very lucky.
Well, let's talk about that process of the transplant from both the perspective of the donor and then you as the recipient. Obviously, I can't just go in and donate a heart and then go on with my life without a heart. But what is the process like for somebody who wants to be a bone marrow donor?
Well, you and I have a mutual friend, Charlie Johnson, who I think 20 or more years ago became a potential donor. And at that time, the process of providing that donor information, I think, was a little more invasive than it is now. For example, I've had, in the course of my treatment now, three bone marrow biopsies. And they do that by putting a needle through your hip to the marrow.
Oof.
And extracting a bit of it and analyzing it. Now, that sounds extremely painful, Frankly, it was a walk in the park. They sedate you. And I felt really nothing except maybe a push.
Okay.
I've also had a spinal tap and a lot of other stuff, but and including a catheter that now extends into my chest, which provides ports, that is, access to my bloodstream that starts at the upper right chest and goes right to the edge of my heart. So I've had those procedures. Well, that bone marrow biopsy would have been an earlier way of accessing information about the bone marrow. Now it is easier. It is. It can actually be a blood draw. And what happens in the case of my donor is that person in mid-September began a series of shots, I think five or so, 5 days in a row, of what they call growth formula. And what that does is stimulate the development of stem cells. And it's the stem cells that you're really getting when you get a bone marrow transplant now.
Okay.
And when those 5 days are over, then the blood is withdrawn and is processed so that it is what's left is an extremely rich concentration of stem cells. If you look at whole blood, for example, it's dark red. If you look at a bag of stem cells that have been processed for a transplant, it's kind of a pinkish lavender. and that those cells are then frozen, and then I am prepped to receive them, and that requires about 5 or 6 days of chemotherapy. And then the last day before the transplant, in my case, that was October 6th, I had a whole body radiation. It's a very low dose of radiation, incidentally. It's not like I'm going to glow in the dark. What they would do is radiate half one side of me and then turn me and radiate the other half. It takes 10 minutes a side, and that's literally to, as much as possible, suppress my production of white blood cells and to suppress my bone marrow, because what you don't want is for you to be fighting the graft, which is what they call the donor here. And on October 7th, in my bed, and I've had many blood transfusions and platelet transfusions in the process of the last several months, just to sustain my modicum of health, in about a half hour's time, it's over. And it's like a blood transfusion. And then you begin a regimen of all kinds of chemotherapy to suppress rejection, to provide antibiotic, antiviral, antifungal protection, because your immune system is severely suppressed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in that condition right now.
Mm-hmm. During a pandemic.
And, yeah. Well, I'm in an isolation ward.
Yeah.
I can have one visitor a day, and everybody has to be masked. Mm. And every 2 hours, my vitals are taken. At 4 a.m. every day, they come in and take several vials of blood. And that's what that port is for, that catheter that is implanted in my chest. It's just that it's much easier to use something like that because you're doing it daily than a regular IV would be. And frankly, less invasive in a way, because IVs have to be changed regularly, and they're no fun. Not
yeah.
This is, but it's easier and less uncomfortable.
Well, 2 weeks out from the transplant now, how are you feeling?
Well, good enough to be discharged.
Well, hey, we'll take
it. Amen. What I was told when I was admitted, that the range of my stay at the hospital would be from 3 weeks to 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I could assume a month would be a generally good idea of how long it would take. And during that process, they're doing these blood draws to determine how well you're tolerating the transplant, which is, again, an infusion. It's not like they're boring into me and cutting into me or anything like that. And seeing, you know, how I was doing overall. In my particular case, and I was really expecting to feel some dramatic negative effects here, like nausea, vomiting, profound weight loss. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any of that, which was fortunate for me because in the previous process of chemotherapy, I lost 30 pounds. Oh. And I still am down 30 pounds, but I haven't lost any more. And my appetite was okay, even with hospital food.
Yeah.
I have thoroughly sampled.
Are you ready to rank, like, least favorite to favorite Jell-O at this point?
Honestly, I like Jell-O. And I selected it many times, although in my particular case, I was not on a restricted diet. I was on a high-protein, high-carbo diet because they want you to maintain as much strength as you can. They encourage you to walk the halls because you need to exercise. And, you know, otherwise you're spending too much time in bed, and that just doesn't help the process along. Mm-hmm. So I was tolerating the procedure and well enough so that I could do all of that stuff. And I was kind of surprising myself.
That's great.
I should have mentioned earlier, as a matter of fact, that typically bone marrow transplants are given to people 65 and under. Mm. I am older than that. I turned 72 while I was in the hospital. And I think they look at your overall health and whether or not you can tolerate it. And I tolerated it very well. So, again, I feel very, very lucky. And I'm, as you and Skip know, I'm an optimist, you know, because you don't, why waste a day or an hour for that matter being a pessimist? It's, you only get so much time and, you know, embrace it for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
So I got out of the hospital actually 3 days before 3 weeks were up. And the doctors say I'm a gold star patient. And of course, my part of that might be to just keep me optimistic, but I am. And I can tell you that before I was released, my white blood cell count was starting to tick up. And every day it was doubling. And yesterday, when they did my blood test, and I'll have another one today, it was in the normal range.
Hey.
And that was...
Yeah.
That was amazing. And my hemoglobin has gone up as well, although that's expected to fluctuate considerably. My platelet count has gone up markedly. So everything is moving in the right direction. And I go into clinic every day now, and they use that port that's still in my chest to draw blood and give me whatever I need to have to balance my numbers, whole blood, platelets. I haven't had any of that in quite a while. Or... in my case yesterday, magnesium. There's something about the chemical cocktails I'm on that depletes the magnesium. They just hitch me up to pole for a half hour or so and put some magnesium into my bloodstream, and I go on my merry way. So today, I'll have a blood test. I'll meet with the doctor. Then I'll have an infusion if I need one. I don't think I'll need one today because of my numbers. And then I come home. I'm staying with my son, who lives 10 minutes away from the hospital, and who actually was staying with me up in Fargo when I got out of the hospital. So he's been a godsend.
Yeah, and you have this nice role reversal of son taking care of the dad here.
That's absolutely correct. And it would be much harder, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it is much harder for most bone marrow transplant patients. But I also have immense hope, frankly, that this is going to work out well because of the quick response my body had to the graft, that is, the donor. The one thing they're looking for very carefully during this process, and will be looking for a good year from now, is what's called graft versus host disease, which is the bone marrow transplant version of rejection. And that can vary from relatively mild to extraordinarily uncomfortable to fatal. So, you know, they're keeping me under close surveillance. And again, I just can't say enough about the skill and professionalism of the people who do this. Dr. Czar back at Sanford and his associates, and Dr. Mukta Arora at the University of Minnesota and her associates. These are people who really know their stuff. And as I've said to many people, if you're going to have acute myeloid leukemia, 2021 is a pretty good year to have it.
You are such an optimist, Doc.
I am, and I think that's part of the process of recovery.
Yeah.
I think the patient's attitude is actually pretty important.
Yeah, I think a lot of studies are showing that, too. Doug, we just have about a minute left here, but our listeners want to know, are you planning on coming back?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I'm an outpatient within 10 minutes of the hospital now for 2 months.
Yeah.
That's the protocol. Then I'll be transferred back up to Sanford, and we'll, you know, continue to visit the clinic there, you know, pretty regularly, having blood draws until probably about a year out, in which case things will slow down a bit in terms of that, and a more normal life will follow. They usually say you can't go back to work for about a year after the process, but as I've told them, my job isn't, you know, a factory work or, you know, farm work or anything like that. I talk. And I'm doing that now, so obviously I can do that. And I look forward to doing it. I mean, I've just been here stewing about who I'd like to talk to. I got all these ideas. And I frankly look forward to it. I enjoy the job. I mean, I'm way past retirement age, but I really like doing it. And I look forward to doing it again as soon as I can.
Well, we look forward to having you back on the air. Main Street host Doug Hamilton with an update on his health journey, 2 weeks off of his bone marrow transplant and treatment for acute myeloid-like leukemia. Doug, thank you so much, and congratulations on the best possible outcome for recovery.
Thank you, Ashley, and thanks everybody who listens to Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Next Blue of North Dakota. All-in-one Medicare Advantage plans made for North Dakotans by North Dakotans. For whatever's next, nextbluend.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And as you know, it gets cold here, and it stays cold for a while. And sure, you can always put on another layer, but what about taking a couple layers off and introducing in some cold and trying to build up tolerance to cold? So there is this guy from Holland. His name is Wim Hof. He is an extreme athlete known for his ability to persevere in extreme cold temperatures, as in hiking up to Everest Base Camp in a pair of shorts. And if you Google Wim Hof or the Iceman, you'll see a lot of image results of him hanging out in shorts on the ice, in the snow, and seemingly being perfectly comfortable. In Bismarck, Angie Cambites has studied with Wim Hof and has used that knowledge to help a group of people build their tolerance to cold, doing something called cold water immersion. On a 57-degree windy day, we met up on the banks of the Missouri River to try it out.
We start with a warm-up. We do kind of a horse stance, and we want to get really low, and we want to start to feel that burn in our thighs. And we start to move the energy with our hands. And then we start to use our breath and our voice.
Hoo, ha, 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 hoo.
And we do this for a little while to warm up.
What is the hoo haing doing?
Letting off steam. Connecting us.
Hoo. Ha, whoo,
moving
ha.
The breath, calming ourselves down, and getting ready.
Okay.
Ha, whoo, ha, whoo, ha, whoo.
And you want to start to feel your thighs kind of burning, right? So you're getting your body really warm, really fast.
Ha.
And we're on the beach. It's a 58-degree day, 57 degrees in the water.
Ha.
We're going to do a little exercise to activate the brown fat in between our shoulder blades. So we take our arms up and we squeeze our shoulder blades together and we scream, ha! And again. So we're connecting ourselves to nature. Here we are, October. It's a cold, windy day, but the sun's out. Most people are probably snuggled inside somewhere, and here we are on the beach.
In a Patagonia puffy.
Hey,
and
hey.
Sweaters.
Hey, soon there will be nothing.
Sweatpants.
Soon it's going to be a bikini.
All right. You said brown fat. What is brown fat?
I'm not sure how much research there is out on the brown fat, but what they know is that children have more brown fat, and it makes you more adaptable to the cold. Maybe this is a reason kids don't get as cold as we do as adults.
Oh.
It goes away as we get older, and we are covered in white fat, which does nothing for us as far as keeping us warm. So there are some theories that maybe Wim Hof has more brown fat. Maybe that with cold exposure, you start to build your brown fat.
Okay. And Wim Hof is?
Wim Hof is a guy. He's from Holland, and he lives in Europe, in Poland and in Holland. He leads expeditions. He set a bunch of Guinness World Book records, climbing Everest in his shorts.
In shorts?
Yes, in shorts. Yes.
He knows it's
not all the
way. Knows it snows up there, right?
Yeah, in the snow. Yeah, he didn't go all the way, but he went up to, I think, maybe the base camp. Also, Kilimanjaro, he leads groups. He's also referred to as the Iceman. So there's a lot of videos out on him. You know, I invited him here.
Yeah?
You know what he said?
Oh, don't even tell
too
me.
Too cold.
No.
Oh, I know.
Too cold for the Iceman?
Too cold for the Iceman.
Wait, what does that say about these three people in front of us?
Crazy.
Okay.
But, you know, I think what he meant is, you know, he's not coming here in the middle of winter. He's crazy, but he's not stupid, right?
Okay.
We don't do this. Usually I don't take people out if it's under 40 degrees. And the water, you know, you don't.
Okay.
The water will only get down to, what, 32? Maybe a little colder because it's moving water. After that, it's ice and we're not going in. So nature stops us naturally.
Okay.
But, yeah, we don't really do this in winter unless it's unseasonably warm. Are we warm yet? Okay, so let's do another brown fat. Ha!
What is the screaming doing?
It's helping us.
It's helping us. I do like screaming at things.
Exactly. It's helping us release. It's helping us kind of connect to our roots to our connection to the earth, right?
Okay. Whoa, the wind picked up. I just got cold again. I need more hooing.
More high.
More hawing.
Okay, so we're going to go in. We're going to go in the water. And you're going to want to hold your breath. And you're going to want to, well, you can scream, but that natural tension that happens, what we want to do is we want to relax into it.
Relax into being jolted into cold water.
Yes.
Okay.
Relax into it.
Sounds totally normal.
Mind over matter here.
You said the cold water helps with the muscles.
Yes, it helps with inflammation. It helps with muscle soreness, specifically. There has been research on that.
That's why athletes take cold water baths?
And cryotherapy, yes. Ice baths, cryotherapy, it's really popular in the athletic world and the biohacker world.
Wow. Okay. They should all train here. Who wants to hold the mic? Run into water, get some reaction. Now we're all pausing. I'm going to watch everybody get undressed. This is radio, friends, so I'm just going to paint a picture here. Everybody is stripping down while I grab my camera, and we take some shots. This might be the strangest story I've ever done. Okay. All right. It's 55 degrees. I hoo-hawed. Okay, I'm going in. Oh, it's cold! Ah, no, I want to scream!
Ah,
oh, okay.
Yes, you got this. Ooh, yeah.
It's really cold.
Relax, it's okay. Here we are, it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Smile.
I can't feel my toes.
That's okay, you don't need to feel them. Right now, all of the blood is leaving your toes and your fingers, and it's coming to your core to keep your core, your heart, warm.
Why are you smiling and looking like beautiful? And I don't know if I can do anymore. I don't know if I can do anymore.
I'm at the beach in October.
Okay. Are we good?
Okay.
Oh, I can't. You guys are way too strong. Oh, my feet are shaking. Okay.
Take all the stuff off and just come.
And now we're going to come in again for real?
Yeah, we're going to.
Hey, wait, that was not real? All right. Okay. I've switched mics, so I'm going to come in again.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
I can't wait till I can be in the zeros with no
very,
gloves.
Very cold.
And I want to be able to run in sandals, no socks this year, this winter.
Oh, wow.
Sub-zero.
How long have you been doing this?
2 years now, I think. Have we done it 2 years or just 1 year? Full year.
What's your name?
Garrett.
Garrett what?
Grail.
Okay. And you've been doing this for 2 years?
At least one full year. Year and a half, something like that.
Like on purpose?
Yeah, on purpose. With Angie, doing the Wim Hof. I've been running in the mountains in the winters. And skiing and like minimal gear, but the official running in sub zeros and just shorts and sneakers is just the last like year, 2 years.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Why? What draws you to this?
Living in the mountains and wanting to be as comfortable as possible in the winter. Being able to run in your sandals. I like running minimally in sandals, barefooted. Trying to run. And colder and colder, and run in blizzards and sandals, and at night and in snowstorms, and it's exciting. It kind of feels like otherworldly. It does. It's like so much stimulation going on.
Like what? What is happening in your body?
It's kind of like being on drugs or something. Your mind is stimulated so much more intensely, but singularly.
Okay.
So, like in the real world, you have all these crazy things stimulating you all at once. It's like you notice everything else around you. Instead of it being here in yourself, it's all around you.
It's like heightened?
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of when I used to ski in Big Sky, and you'd come ripping down Lone Peak in a blizzard with like earbuds in and goggles on, and you're so isolated from what's outside, but it's so crazy around you. That's kind of what it feels like.
So my first reaction, I got in the water, I screamed, I came out after like 15 seconds, I went back in kind of... hardly. You're just like calm.
the first time I got in with Angie, I could barely catch my breath. I was like, and then like 45 seconds later or so, you gain your composure and
So the ladies are back on the beach warming up afterwards again.
I forget the way they put it when I was reading some stuff from Wim Hof. And I did this over the summer. So this cold water stuff, it helps you in the summer and it helps you in the winter. So like when it's 100 degrees out and you're running and you're melting and boiling and you have heat exhaustion kicking in, if you can, and it's the same with the cold, if you can remove, you observe what's going on, the heat or the cold, but you don't let it affect you and you become like separated. So it allows you to do things that we think that we can't do. It's almost like, it's just like a meditation.
And now you have superpowers.
Yeah, superpowers. Yeah.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And what you just heard was me trying out a cold water immersion technique that can help you build your tolerance to cold and help you with some stress management and immune boosting. I was doing that with Angie Cambites. And after we did that, we got all nice and warm. We did some exercises. We drank some tea. And then we went back to her house to talk about the experience. And as you probably heard, I got a little panicky in the water. I was very cold and I didn't really like it. And she just locked eyes with me and told me to breathe deeply.
Our body's natural response to stress is to freak out. This is new. This is dangerous. This is a moving river. And it's cold. It was 57 degrees today in the water, maybe colder as we went deeper. There's good reason to freak out. Yeah. And you're cold. You know, you don't know what's happening. You start to lose some of that orientation of what's supposed to happen. I'm really uncomfortable. And it's real. It's not just a perceived uncomfortable. This is hurting your body uncomfortable. Okay. So what is happening is there is that vasoconstriction. Right. So the blood is leaving your toes. It's leaving your fingers. Everything, all the veins are constricting. So keeping that core warm.
Oh, right? That's where all the important organs
all
are.
All the important, right? That's your survival. So we need to stay warm there. I know we're safe. I know this water isn't that cold. 57 really isn't that cold. We're just not used to it.
It felt really cold to me.
It is really cold, right? Mm-hmm. But it's right. Not like we're going into 30 degree water. Mm-hmm. That's the difference, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I know we're going to be okay. I've done this, so I have the experience of, I know we're going to be okay. But in our brains, right, we go into panic mode.
Yeah.
When something is scary. And to have somebody there with you and eye contact, breathe, right? And so we're using that pranayama technique, an ancient yogic breathing technique of inhale and exhaling, extending our exhale to actually calm our nervous system, slowing down our heart rate. We're slowing down our mind through the breath, right? Because the breath wants to go into panic,
yeah,
right? And what do we do when we panic? We stop breathing or we start to hyperventilate. And we're not actually breathing, right? We're taking these little shallow breaths. And so that's actually making our nervous system kind of go into overdrive. And the yogis figured this out thousands of years ago, right? Where calm your breath, calm your nervous system, calm your mind. So that's essentially what we're doing. And we're putting ourselves in a stressful situation on purpose.
Why?
Because we're crazy. To make us stronger, right? Not just stronger to cold water, but really looking at it as a metaphor for life, right? Life comes at you. Stressful situations come at you, right? And it is so easy for us to panic and have a hard time and hyperventilate when a stressful situation comes and really lose ourselves, right? And so by putting ourselves in a stressful situation and learning to calm our minds, to calm our bodies, to calm our parasympathetic nervous system, to calm it all down, we can then approach life in the same way. Maybe those things that were stressors are going to be less stressful now. And ideally, looking at it from a yogic perspective, we want to be able to remain calm no matter what happens. Of course you're allowed to have a reaction. Of course you're allowed to scream. Of course you're allowed to get angry. Mm-hmm. Nobody's telling you to just bottle it up and act like it's not happening. Let the emotion out, but don't let that emotion take over your life. Don't let it rule how you are in the world. Don't be so afraid of the cold that you don't go outside. It was beautiful out there, wasn't it?
Eventually. Well, no, it was beautiful. The water was cold. But then, you know, after my first time where I went in and I definitely defaulted to, I just want to freak out and panic here. Right. Yeah. I went in and a second time and I was a little bit better. And then the third time I was
acclimated. Yeah, you were able to calm down.
Yeah. That, and I think it maybe was, no, it was still really cold, but then, yeah. But then coming out, it was weird. I felt like more awake than I have on three cups of coffee.
Yeah. And it does that, right? It wakes you right up.
Hmm.
It brings you to the present moment like nothing else. All of these traditions, these ancient traditions of, you know, mastering your mind. Where are the problems? The problems are in the past. Perceived problems are in the future, right? Be here now. It's really hard for us to do, right? Because our mind keeps traveling back and forth, back and forth. And so we have our anxieties and we have our isms. Be here now. Mm-hmm. Well, the cold water makes you be here right now.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
now. And in that moment.
I was feeling it.
Yeah, in that moment. You can't think about anything else. Nothing else matters. It is a survival. And we've lost that, becoming very domesticated with fluorescent lights, temperature control, nice warm fuzzy jackets all the time.
Yeah.
And actually in a place where we don't have to deal with nature.
Mm.
So we've lost that very human part of us that is very animal, if you will. For thousands of years, we were completely connected to nature. And we're so comfortable now that we run at the idea of what is perceived uncomfortable. We don't even want to deal with it. And athletes, I think, understand this. I think athletes have no problems going in the ice baths and the cryotherapy because this is, it's a different mindset, right? This is part of my training to get stronger, to get tougher, so I can overcome whatever I need to overcome for my sport. And it's a different mindset. You just overcame your fear, your hatred of cold. I'm not saying it's going to be gone forever, right? But because you did that, think of all the other things that your mind is stopping you from doing. Think of all the other things you can do now.
Well, we do have to talk about safety, though, because that was cold water. So how do you make sure that you're not going to give yourself a heart attack doing this?
When I take people with me, they are all volunteers. I do ask people if they have any heart conditions. I ask that people with heart conditions and high blood pressure don't come. This is the Missouri. It is quite powerful. So we are dealing with that force of nature as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people die in the river. That is why it's very important to have a group of people. The water is cold, but we're only staying in there from a minute to 3 minutes. There's no sense in trying to be a superhero here or becoming, you know, oh, I'm really going to push it and I'm going to stay 10 minutes or 15 minutes. That's when hypothermia happens. So keeping it at 1 minute to 3 minutes is very safe.
And then the warm-ups before and after.
Yes.
You gave everybody tea. You made them get dressed.
Yes.
Okay.
And so we get our core very warm instantly. You know, in the winter, put hats on, put gloves on. We want to get warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, oh, look how tough I am. I could be cold forever. No, no. Right? It's about doing it and then being responsible about it. So I don't recommend this for people to just go jump in the water. Right? Mm-hmm. Start with a cold shower. That's a really good way to start. Start with a hot shower because those are delicious. And then start to turn your shower colder for a few seconds. And every day get it a little colder and maybe go a second longer. And eventually get to a place where maybe you don't even need the hot shower.
How long have you been doing this?
Let's see. I went to the Wim Hof expedition in Poland in January 2020. And so I started training for that in probably about October of 2019. I started really training with cold showers.
What are the benefits that you're seeing in your own life? And then maybe what are some other benefits of somebody who does this for a long time?
I'm not an athlete per se, but I like that mindset. Right? So I'm always trying to push myself to be a little better, to try a little harder.
Mm-hmm.
Living in North Dakota, I'm not from here. I'm from California originally. I'm from sunny San Diego.
Mm-hmm. So this is all Wim Hof to you.
This is all Wim Hof. But I've been really miserable. I've been really miserable for a long time because, mm-hmm. you know, winter is coming and 6 months of winter, it's hardcore here. It's mm-hmm. not just a little winter. We have a lot of winter and it's a very cold winter. And that's been really hard on me. And yet I needed the Wim Hof expedition. I needed the cold to make me okay with being here, to accept it.
Mm.
And it's fascinating how many people are from here and how much they hate it here. Not necessarily hate it. They hate the cold here. Oh, mm-hmm. I hate the cold.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't believe I live here. Well, you're from here. Yeah, I can't believe I still live here. I'm miserable. I hate the cold. Okay. So are you going to go through life just living here and despising the cold, which mm-hmm. is inevitable? And it's very cold here. This is not a normal cold. Or at some point, are you going to do something about it?
Mm.
So it's made me a lot stronger. There's just something human about connecting us to nature. I feel very lucky to live in Bismarck where we have this wonderful river and I call it a beach. It's my Southern Californian version of a beach, right? I like beaches a lot and I have one. It's maybe not my ideal beach, but it's very exotic.
Bismarck's going to get a new slogan.
You can take the girl out of California, but you can't take the California out of the girl. You know, and there's a certain joy, right? All the people that were there with us today, they're smiling and they're laughing. And there is a community. So we have the community with the friends that are doing this. And we're all kind of crazy together, but that's okay because we're together. And we're outside enjoying nature. And that's huge. That's something we have lost. And today was a little hard because this morning it was raining, it was cloudy, it was cold, it was windy, and I didn't really want to do this. Mm-hmm. I really didn't want to, and I'm just, oh, I don't know. And what's coming up is fear. Mm-hmm. Fear, right? And Wim has a great saying. He says, I don't let the fear come to me. I go to the fear. But that's all mindset. I decide who's the boss here. I decide how I'm going to react to things. And that's what we're learning in psychology and child development, right? In all the fields, we're learning that I have to be the master of my own mind and my own reactions.
I might stick with cold showers a little longer, but thank you, Angie.
Thank you.
That was Angie Kambites. She is a yoga teacher in Bismarck. She studied once with Wim Hof, also known as the Iceman, about different ways to use your mind and your breath to control your reaction to the cold. And I should note that she was comfortable with me doing this because she knows that I also have a regular yoga and breath control practice and had been doing a little bit of training since July when we first talked about doing this story by taking cold showers. She recommends for anybody who is interested in doing this, talk to your doctor and you can read about Wim Hof at wimhofmethod.com and you can start training by taking cold showers.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Here's Chuck Lura from Dakota College of Botany with Natural North Dakota.
A friend recently told me all about the Baltimore Orioles they had been observing, complete with a cell phone picture of the Oriole feeding on half an orange at their feeder. Most everyone's familiar with the Baltimore Oriole, but it might surprise you that North Dakota has three species of orioles. The Baltimore Oriole and the Orchard Oriole range over much of the state. The Orchard Oriole is darker, with orange being less prominent. The Bullock's Oriole may be found southwest of the Missouri River. It's a chunkier oriole with a brighter coloration, and unlike the Baltimore Oriole, which has a dark head, the Bullock's head is orange with a black cap and eye stripe. Baltimore Orioles utilize habitats of open woodland and small groves of trees, as well as parks, backyards, and the like. It's interesting to note that one of their winter habitats are the coffee and cocoa plantations of Central America. Ornithologist Arthur Cleveland Bent described the song of the Baltimore Oriole in his Life Histories of Familiar North American Birds as, and I quote, "the softest, sweetest voice of all our birds," unquote. The Oriole's song is somewhat reminiscent to that of a robin, but more liquid, sweet, and pure. And of course, who among us has not been intrigued by the sight of an oriole nest? How do they make that hanging nest of various fibric materials? That material may include such things as grasses, hair, wool, string, thread, twine, and the like. It seems like nimble fingers and an opposable thumb and well-developed brain would be prerequisites for such a construction. No doubt many among us think the Baltimore Oriole is named after the city in Maryland. However, Cornell University's All About Birds website notes the Baltimore Oriole is so named because the coloration of the oriole, bright orange and black, is similar to the coloration of England's Baltimore family crest. So be on the lookout for Baltimore Orioles in your area, and keep your ears open to their interesting song. And if you really want to see and hear them, put out a nectar feeder, half an orange and some grape jelly. You'll be richly rewarded. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
When we reflect on our lives, we often see a thread that leads from one event to the next.
And that is wrong. There is no thread. There is just sort of an infinite cloud of possibilities. The future has not been created yet.
How our minds impose meaning on the random. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tomorrow at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this weekend edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in all week during our 2 o'clock Mountain, 3 o'clock Central time slot for your week's dose of interesting, fascinating conversation. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.